This week on Death of the Reader, a puzzle with 14 authors of the Detection Club, the elusive yet highly acclaimed solution of Agatha Christie herself, and we speak to Simon Brett on what this Detection Club is. Stick around. You're listening to 2SER 107.3. This is Flex and Herds bringing you Death of the Reader, your murder mystery world tour. These mysterious tunes brought to you by Paul Meter, our audio extraordinaire. Today, Herds, you're tackling The Floating Admiral, written by The Detection Club.
Well, thank you, Flex. Wait a second, The Detection Club? Who's the author?
Well, I was hoping you'd read the introduction at the beginning of the book so you would, you know, go into this with a bit of understanding.
I have some understanding, but I think I'd like to explain to us what's going on here.
So, part of the Murder Mystery World Tour gimmick is that we're taking you around the world, connecting author to author, following their inspirations, their touchstones, everything that led them to be who they are. Mm. Last book we looked at was The Three Taps by Ronald Knox, and we've decided to branch out to Knox's compatriots, companions, contemporaries in the Detection Club, a group of some of the most prolific authors of the golden age of detective fiction.
Yeah, and we'll be starting with The Floating Admiral, which is a pretty tricky one, from what I understand. We're doing the first four chapters just to kick us off for this episode. And yeah, the Detection Club, it's a group of like-minded murder mystery enthusiasts, along with Knox and Agatha Christie and some others you might may or may not be familiar with, just getting together and writing murder mysteries and challenging each other, which I think is really cool.
So The Floating Admiral is a very interesting story, and you might have heard me speak to Andrew Popel about it. It's a story where each chapter was written by a different author, and none of them told each other what the answer was meant to be.
So it's basically a game of Chinese whispers, but with the murder mystery.
Yes, it
is. That's excellent. And apparently I'm being charged to solve this thing, despite the fact that it's being written by multiple authors, none of whom know what the answer is, and everyone's trying to, like, figure out what it is while they're writing it? Is that what's happening?
Yeah, I've thrown you a bit of a curveball here. Yeah. You awarded me 1 point for the solving of the Three Taps
Can
by
I have
Knox.
4 points? How many chapters are there? Yeah. How many chapters are there? For every one I get right, do
well,
I get a point?
Well, there's 12 chapters, the conclusion and the prologue. I'll give you 1 whole point for it.
You know what? I'll take it. This is the best I'm going to get on this show.
Actually, you know what? I will say, and we'll talk about this coming up a bit later in the show, but several of the reviews, both modern and contemporary of this novel, have said that Agatha Christie's solution to the story is worth the sales price of the book alone.
Oh.
So if you can get the official solution and Agatha Christie's solution, you can have 3 points.
Oh, boy. And that's part of this, isn't it? She's chapter four, isn't she?
She's chapter four.
Oh, I guess we'll have to see how I go later on then. My goodness. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, so it's one of these very, very strange things. You think when you have a puzzle, you'd like to know that it can be solved.
Mm-hmm.
But in this case, we have a puzzle where we don't know if we can solve it. It's almost by premise against the rules of Knox, where the author should be letting you know that it's fair and solvable.
We do also have that prologue, which apparently was written after the rest of the book was put together.
Yes.
So there might be some clues in there, I hope. I'm banking a lot on those.
The prologue by G.K. Chesterton and the conclusion by Anthony Berkeley, the two things that were written with the full knowledge of the book. So you've got a little helping hand there with that introduction.
Yeah, I'm hoping. I have some thoughts on that, but we'll get to that later.
The description of G.K. Chesterton's prologue is typically paradoxical.
It's great.
So you don't want to take that without your helping of salt.
Your powder keg full of salt?
Is yeah.
But yeah, the club itself, it was kind of a secret society, right? Did they, like, sell those books? I don't really know much about it.
They did sell those books. The society was more or less secret, as I understand it, in terms of how to join and gain membership and what they actually did. You know, now it's all out in the open, searchable on Wikipedia, as Simon Brett in the edition that we're reading mentions in his foreword. Speaking of that, we have Simon Brett himself, former chairman of the Detection Club, on the show a bit later, so stick around for that.
Yeah, he reckons it was founded in 1928, which is, you know, it's a pretty old society to still be around.
Yeah, I think that when you approach this story and you think of the Detection Club, it's probably worth keeping in mind that this was like a bunch of friends with very differing opinions and views and writing styles who just like to meet for dinner and discuss murder mysteries.
Yeah, well, it definitely has that feeling of fun to it, and that's something that's part of the foreword as well, that's kind of been lost in more modern murder mysteries, that feeling of fun, that feeling of, you know, we can throw some of the realistic rules, you know, some of the drama of crime fiction out the window and go for something a bit more lighthearted, even in the subject of murder, as the story is.
Well, I wouldn't even necessarily say it's about lightheartedness. I think it's more just about the story being secondary to the game.
For sure, yeah.
I was particularly impressed, aside from the prologue, which is very much out of character with the rest of the book, but with intention, mind you. But I was very much impressed with how all four opening chapters seem to fit and flow together.
Yeah.
There wasn't any moment in the first four where I really felt like, oh, that's where they switched authors, yeah. You know, even though it did tell us.
One of the most interesting writing techniques that I noted, that I noticed after every chapter, all of the chapters end on a cliffhanger or the introduction of a character or something that's sort of like a throw to the next writer. Like, oh, and this is when we, I can't think off the top of my head, but like, this is when, you know, we're going to talk to the niece of the admiral, that we're going to go to their house. And then the next chapter is about that. And in particular, jumping from the second to the third chapter where we've had our lovely chat with the niece, and then the tape is like, I just want you to stay in the house. And then she's just run away in a car, which is fantastic. Like the way that we kind of flow from chapter to chapter isn't just, this is the end and then it's a new story. There's a call to action that's kind of thrown at the end of each chapter that we have to grab onto.
Yeah, I think it's very much worth reading the introduction by Dorothy L. Sayers before you get to the story, because they went into this game of writing a novel split between a group of people with a set of rules on how they were going to approach it. Like, one author could not throw in unnecessarily challenging details purely for the purpose of making it more difficult. Whether or not they succeeded in that is an entirely different matter.
I feel like that's definitely something that happened. We'll get into that. I mean, you've read the whole thing. You have a better idea of than I do, but I definitely feel like there are some clues that are thrown in that kind of contradict or completely reframe previous scenes, which is like a little bit of a throw, but you know.
But I do think that was probably part of their game plan, is that each chapter was meant to end with, this is the puzzle piece that you were meant to pick up on.
Yep. I also like that because most murder mystery novels, you tend to have that flow of chapters because you start off with the introduction, and there's the big murder scene, and then there's this kind of slower introduction to the characters, and then things pick up again when complications start to arise. And then it, you know, peters out as the solution is resolved and the detective figures everything out, whatever. But the thing that I really enjoyed about this novel is how every chapter, because it's written by a different author, they maintain that intensity all the way through. And I feel like that is a huge selling point. If you want to like recommending it to someone, if you want to read something where every chapter has a significant clue and a different way of approaching the mystery, this is the one.
Yeah, it very nicely follows where your headspace is as a reader, because each of the authors was trying to figure out what the hell was going on at the same time you are.
Yep.
So you're never left behind by the author that you might be in one that is written by a single author.
Yeah, they're almost trying to, like, I could imagine that the authors are trying to puzzle out the previous one, the previous chapters, while also pushing their own agenda, in a sense, which is a really fun game of tag, almost.
Yeah, one thing that it does tell you in Dorothy L. Sayers's introduction is that at the end of the book, the appendices feature the solutions from every single author as to what they thought the outcome was meant to be.
I am looking forward to reading those immensely, because I hope that, like, half of them are like two sentences and that's it. And the others are like these full essays on all these little details that go all the way back around and everything makes sense at the end.
Now, the victim for the floating admiral is in fact the floating admiral.
What? That's crazy that the admiral would be floating and also be dead.
Yes. Admiral Peniston, which if you have children in the backseat of your car is spelt the way they think.
Oh my goodness. That's inappropriate.
It is very. Also a real place in England, I found out in researching. Now, the Admiral is found in a situation which, as with many a murder mystery, simply does not make sense.
Mm-hmm.
He's found in a boat, in the river, stabbed through the heart in a large overcoat. The rope down to the boat has been cut. Obviously, foul play is involved. And he's found by this strange gentleman named Neddy Ware.
I just want to say I'm thankful it's not a locked room mystery.
That is a very interesting detail about this story. The locked room is an absolute staple of the murder mystery genre.
Literally.
And I guess you could extrapolate on this being a locked room by some of the clues, but that's a very loose definition to take.
Well, the details that we have is that he's on a boat and it's the vicar's boat. So like somebody had to put him there.
Exactly.
You know, so there are still some details that we can roll with. Immediately implicating the vicar. Anyway,
we'll speak a bit more about those solutions as we press on in the story, but right now I'm very excited. We have Simon Brett, author of the foreword of the edition of the book we're reading, acclaimed author in his own right, and former chairman of the Detection Club. Up next.
You're listening to SCR on 107.3, and this is Flex and Hertz with Death of the Reader, your Murder Mystery World tour. Today we have a very special guest with us, Mr. Simon Brett, from all the way over in the great England itself, once president of the Detection Club. Simon, how are you doing today?
I am very good, thank you.
It's excellent, that's excellent. Our resident Flex here has actually read one of your novels. I hear it's called A Decent Interval, so this is a real treat for him.
Yeah, when I was first getting into detective fiction and going from a casual reader of it to a, you know, keen solver of the stories, some of the Charles Parrish novels were the first ones that I got into to actually figure out how the genre works. So it's very exciting to get the opportunity to speak to you, Simon.
Oh, well, you're clearly a man of discrimination.
I look forward to reading the novel myself when I can get around to it.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you, you're quite the writer yourself. You've been penning murder mysteries since 1965 with Cast in Order of Disappearance. I'd just like to ask, why
did
you...
Yeah, actually 1975.
He's 75, rather. Yes, indeed.
Yes. I'm quite old, but not that old.
Why did you start writing initially, Simon?
It came directly out of my day job at that time, which was being a radio producer, would you believe?
Oh,
and
I would.
I was working at the BBC, and I was delegated to produce a series of adaptations of the Dorothy L. Sayers' Lord Peter Wimsey stories. And I'd always been a bit frightened of mystery fiction up until that point. You know, I thought you needed a computerized brain to work out the plot. But in fact, as I worked very closely with the guy who was adapting the book, a writer called Chris Miller, I got less frightened of the genre because I found, well, we found some lovely things like great big holes in Dorothy L. Sayers' plots, which was very encouraging. but also I found that character and dialogue were at least as important as the plot. And so I thought, well, I don't know whether I can do plots. And there are still newspaper critics of this opinion, but I think I can do character and dialogue. And that's what got me into writing the first of my Charles Parrish actor detective murder mysteries.
Yeah, and actually, you mentioned earlier that you were a radio producer. I did some research. I found that you actually hosted a radio panel called Foul Play, in which you
I did, yes.
Yeah, would you like to tell us about that?
Murder mystery panel show, which ran for a couple of series. It was enormous fun. I mean, it was the way it worked. I wrote it and chaired it, and we had two very clever improv actors who I'd sort of, you know, I'd give them the brief of what their character had done, and then they were cross-examined by two other crime writers, and the format worked very well.
Just one last question. How can we copy that idea successfully, Simon?
Oh, by negotiating with my agent for a huge fee for the format.
Of course.
We'll be on the phone as soon as we're off with you. Now, I wanted to turn this a little bit towards the Detection Club, which you were the president of.
Yes, I was the president of. I gave it up about 4 years ago. But,
yeah.
To a younger man called Martin Edwards. But no, I was president for 14 years, so I know it fairly well.
The novel that we're covering alongside our chat with you here is The Floating Admiral, which you wrote a foreword to. And we had lots of fun picking apart that mystery and seeing, you know, how the various authors constructed their different parts of the puzzle.
Yep.
But I wanted to ask, in your foreword, you noted that the club has opened its doors a lot broader since the initial days of the Detection Club to the genres of crime fiction at large, where back in the beginning it was something of a secret society. What do you think led to that widening of the gate?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's because the genre has changed so much. And in fact, a few years ago, we did a sort of sequel to The Floating Admiral called, would you believe, The Sinking Admiral, which was written by 14 current members of the Detection Club. And That was much more difficult because I know because I edited it. Because back in, well, it was published about 1930, The Floating Admiral. And then, although they were very different, the contributors like Dorothy L. Sayers, Agatha Christie, E.C. Bentley, D.K. Chesterton, although they were different in their styles, they were writing very much the same kind of whodunit mystery. So they could literally write a chapter and pass it on to the next one to sort of sort out the plotting, whereas it was a much more complex operation when I did it because, you know, there were legal thrillers, there were financial thrillers, there were all kinds of different subgenre of the mystery.
And do you think that the broader scope that crime fiction has these days ultimately makes a better story, or do you think it's more just the fact that it's a reflection of the times?
I think there are a lot of reasons why. I mean, we look back to the Golden Age, which was the 20s and the 30s, and I think what happened was the Second World War was very important in the development of the mystery, because up until then, you know, a lot of the classics of the Golden Age, as it's called, were really very playful, you know, and they were jokey about murder and death. And I think the Second World War, when, you know, very few families didn't know somebody who was a casualty, that made it slightly less tasteful. And also, I think all the good sort of, you know, clockwork toy plots had been done and the mystery had to change. And the other thing, which I think was very significant in English mystery, was the end of the death penalty, where suddenly, you know, it was great in the days of Agatha Christie, where Hercule Poirot could gather everyone into the library at the end and say, you know, you couldn't have done it because you were wearing the wrong size of trousers, and you couldn't have done it because of your blood group and all this. Therefore, the murderer was you. And he points a finger at somebody, and the reader knows that that person is going off to the gallows. You know, end of story. Suddenly, when you don't have a death penalty, you get sort of lifetime sentences, and you get, you know, people being released at the end of their sentences, that kind of thing. And I think it became, you know, whereas it had been very black and white, it became somebody of Shades of Grey. There might be a title for some kind of book in there. I don't know.
I think particularly what interests me about what you said there was the idea that, you know, all of the clockwork puzzles had been done. Clearly there are still modern examples of classic detective fiction. How do you think that the genre can still innovate on those clockwork puzzles, even though so many of the possibilities for the closed room have been done, per se?
I think it's pretty difficult, and I have great admiration for people who, you know, can come up. I mean, I think there are a lot of writers out there who are very good at doing twists, you know, where something is totally unexpected and, you know, as you read, you go, oh, gosh. But I can think of very few that are based on sort of one simple device. I mean, like, you know, let us say that the narrator is the murderer. Well, we all know that's been done many times. I mean, the only post-war example I can think that is a really effective twist murder based on one central device is A Kiss Before Dying by Ira Levin, which I think is that, I won't say what it is, but it's based on one very simple, almost grammatical device. And that works brilliantly. And I think people have been trying to replicate that, but not actually with marked success.
Yeah, I think particularly looking back on the classic days of detective fiction, we have things like Willard Wright's 27 Rules for the genre and Ronald Knox's Decalogue of Fair Play for the genre. Are those things still treated with any level of seriousness? I know that originally Knox wrote his rules kind of just poking fun, as you say authors back then did, but is there any attention paid to those structures and forms that were laid out back then in the modern age of crime fiction?
I think, as you say, you know, the Knox one was very much tongue-in-cheek, but I think, I mean, there were good, you know, it did make some points about the clichés or the memes or tropes of the genre, you know, in a fairly amiable way. I would say the one rule that kind of was in there and you should still obey is that the, you know, if you're doing a murder mystery where it's a whodunit, you want to know who did it, it is important that the actual perpetrator is introduced fairly early in the book, that you don't suddenly sort of parachute them in the penultimate chapter. I think that rule still obtains, but most of the others are kind of, you know, were just fun, really.
Yeah, I know that there's several stories we've been covering and investigating that have made various deconstructions of their own of those forms of the genre from back in the day. But Simon, thank you so much for your time. It was wonderful to speak with you about all things of your own writing and the Detection Club.
Well, it's a great pleasure.
I hope you've all enjoyed hearing from Simon Brett. It's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you, Simon, and I'm a particular keen fan of Charles Parrish, and I can't wait to get back into those stories.
Great.
You're on 2SER. This is Death of the Reader. That was Simon Brett, and you're investigating the Floating Admiral. You're on 2SER 107.3. This is Death of the Reader, your murder mystery world tour, and we are talking about The Floating Admiral by the Detection Club, discussing chapters 1 to 4. I've read the whole thing. Herds has only read to chapter 4.
Mm-hmm.
And today, we are going to try and get him to solve it with that information alone. And when I say get him to solve it, I mean quite the opposite.
You mean solve every chapter individually, because that's basically how this thing is written. It's great. It's great. I'm looking forward to this, guys. Look, I got this in the bag.
Yeah, I mean, so far, already in the story, we've had 5 different authors. We're 4 chapters and a prologue in.
Well,
you have a lot of solving to do for very little story.
It's okay. I got this. This is my introduction into the ring. I got my mitts on. I got my... I guess if you like my notepad and pen, it's very hard to hold those in these mitts, but you know what? I'll give it my best shot. So yeah, I've got some theories. I've got some thoughts. I think that I'm sticking with my idea that every chapter probably has a different criminal, which is fantastic for me. But I'm going to try and nail down who I think the ultimate killer is. So I'm going to run through my process a little bit here, because we got a couple of characters that I find particularly suspicious. That's Ware, that's the vicar, the admiral's niece, not daughter, Fitzgerald. And that's it. Just those three. Those are the three that I find the most suspicious. I suppose Holland as well.
Now, remember, you're going to get bonus points for getting Christy right.
I will. So I'm still thinking about Holland over there. That's the part that I'm kind of going back and forth. But let me run you through my thought process. So the vicar, particularly interesting to me because he's only been in one chapter really so far, but he is suspicious as heck. He fumbles his words and he doesn't know what he's saying. And when he's asked questions, he's like, yes, the dress was definitely hidden and no, it wasn't. And it was in the trees, but it wasn't actually. And I could see everything and the admiral was definitely there and he wasn't. It's a load of garbage. I think the vicar is an accomplice at the very least.
Okay. You make no mention of the fact that his hat was in the boat and
his hat was in the boat.
It was his boat.
Those are also clues that I picked up on. Point is, that's less important.
You don't think that that's a little too suspicious? I don't think so.
As
an accomplice, he would have been, you know, scared to go out with this plan if his equipment that was left there.
It's entirely possible he's been strong-armed into this or somebody else is using his equipment. I don't think that it is actually him who killed anyone. That's where I'm at right now. I think it's more likely Ware or Fitzgerald.
Here's the other thing.
Yeah.
Is that the Detection Club was a group of mostly devout Christians, including priests.
It's true.
Do you not think that it would have been against the general modus operandi of the group to frame a, you know, church man as a guilty party in their own story?
That's a good question, isn't it? That would be very playing against type, though, wouldn't it? You got me with a good one. I mean, it's possible. I think that would also be a very fun thing to do, to portray this is when, you know, a good man goes bad or something like that. Or maybe, as you say, maybe it is the vicar's sons. They're the accomplices. And the vicar is like trying to cover for his kids. Maybe that's what's happening. Maybe that's the twist.
You reckon?
Yeah, maybe. Who knows?
I think that could also possibly explain why the vicar's alibi is so clearly rehearsed.
Yes, that was something that I was going to mention. He says, I put my hat on the hat stand at 9:20, and that's exactly when I got here. And don't you worry about where I was at any other time. That's the only time that matters. The way that he talks is just so like stilted and like, I have this idea in my head. I think he might be trying to cover for his boys. but I'm not 100% on the Vicar. I don't think he's a killer, though. Certainly not in chapter one.
Now, Herds, I have entitled this battle The Crux of Christie.
Why would you call it that?
Because, as I mentioned earlier on this day, the Agatha Christie solution to the story is said to be worth the admissions price of the book alone.
Yep.
Now, Herds, does this to you scream that Agatha Christie's solution that she was thinking of is the best, the most accurate, the least accurate, but most entertaining?
Probably that one. It probably means it's as far from the actual truth as you can get, and is probably very complicated. Now, I'm trying to recall, that was just the conversation with Mrs. Davies.
It was indeed.
Yes, it was the mostly conversation chapter, which was excellent, by the way.
I would have entitled it entirely conversation, mind you, but not to worry.
Yeah, I think, because the main piece of information that we kind of learned from that chapter is that the Admiral could not have gone to London, so somebody must have brought him the newspaper, and that the Admiral came to the inn where she's at and was all, "Is Mr. Holland here?" And then I don't remember what response he got. It was probably no.
Well,
and then he went away.
He got the response, which was, "We'll go fetch him." And then he said, "Not the matter. I need to leave anyway."
Yes. So, oh man.
And if that in fact was the Admiral, he couldn't have been the one lying in the Vicar's boat because he would have been on a train instead.
You're absolutely correct. You're absolutely correct. So it was probably someone else. I mean, there are so few options. It could be the Vicar as an accomplice, but I don't think that, like, makes a lot of sense for him to do that. He's a churchman, after all. He would never get involved in murder. I think it's more likely Holland himself, honestly, if I had to pick a character.
You don't think that Mrs. Davis would have recognized one of her own patrons?
Not if you were wearing a disguise, like a coat or something that the Admiral normally wears.
I don't know. Mrs. Davis seems like a pretty keen eye in many ways.
I suppose. I'm trying to recall exact how the timing would line up.
Well, that's the thing, is that it wouldn't really, would it?
Unless there's like, unless it's twins, but I don't think, we haven't been prepared for twins at all.
We have not been prepared for twins. And I will put that on the table. I'm going to side with Father Knox on this one.
Yeah, fair enough.
Now, I will say that if it was the Vicar, you know, then he would have been on his way to London by the time that they came to rouse him in the morning to let him know about the crime.
Right.
If it was Holland, he wouldn't have been able to barge back into the house when we visited there earlier on in the story. If it was Nettie Ware, he was well known to the village, as was the first sentence of description of him in the entire story. What else could it have been other than the Vicar's two boys standing on each other's shoulders?
Hold on. Do we actually get told? That's a good one, though. Wearing the Admiral's coat, it makes so much sense. But as you say, the keen eye of Mrs. Davies is testimony in and of itself.
Exactly.
She could be lying, I suppose.
Does this make you think that there's perhaps a character important to the story who we have not been introduced to yet?
Oh, I mean, obviously. Hold on. You say that like we haven't had a character introduced us in like every damn chapter. We've had like four so far.
However,
it's going to be a new one every chapter.
As your trusting compatriot, one would hope that I had presented you an adequate challenge in the first four chapters of the book, and thus the people you needed to solve the mystery. So what is this mysterious extra person?
I don't know.
Does this person exist at all?
I don't think so. There can be no mysterious
person. Do
you
think Mrs. Davis is in on the crime and this is her alibi?
No, that's insane. I mean, it might be. That'd be pretty fun, though. I think that they called for Mr. Holland, and it was probably a male. I at least trust Mrs. Davies as much to figure out as it's a male individual. So the only reason they could be calling for Mr. Holland would be to either confirm their alibi or to give them something or, you know, interact with them. I think that confirming the alibi of Mr. Holland would probably be the main goal. It's a tough one. Christy, why do you torture me so?
Yes, and this is why we have rounded out here. This is why we finished on chapter four.
You know what? It's fine. I'll give another whack in the next roundabout fight, I suppose. I'm going to say it was Holland calling from himself when there was some altercation, but that's not my final answer. I'm coming back for you, Christy.
Oh, boy.
I'm coming for you.
Alrighty. Well, thank you for joining us on Death of the Reader here on 2SER 107.3. Next week, we will be discussing chapters 5 to 8 of The Floating Admiral, starting with Inspector Rudge Begins to Form a Theory by John Rowe.
Oh, boy.
We'll have to see if we can even trust Inspector Rudge's theory.
I hope we can. Are you saying that Inspector Rudge is a suspect? I had not even considered him. You know what?
I will make no confirmations nor denials.
I'm scared.
See you then.